Dudu's complaint. Potiphar, as everybody knew, could not abide Dudu, on the ground of the pompousness he saw in the stout little man. The Osiris Mount Caw had always been irritated by the dwarf, and for the same reason. I have said already that the courtier held at a distance the keeper of his jewel chests, did not see him if he could help it, and interposed other servants between them, people of the regulation size, who for that reason were better able to dress and undress that towering form and adorn it, whereas Dudu would have had to use a pair of steps. But aside from that, being of the same size as other people, they laid less stress on certain natural gifts and sun powers, and assumed less dignity on account of them than Dudu did, to whom they amounted to a lifelong marvel and proud distinction. Thus it was by no means easy for the pygmy to arrive at speech with the master, now that he had at last decided to take the bypath which branched off from the road so assiduously trodden between mistress and steward. He did not succeed all at once after that quarrel with the mock vizier before the curtained room. Not days but weeks had he to wait to announce himself before he got audience. He, the scribe of the jewels, had to bribe the slaves, or else threaten them that he would withhold this or that dress or ornament, would simply not unlock his wardrobes, so that they would get into trouble with the master if they did not force it upon his notice that Dudu would and must speak to him on a very weighty domestic concern. A whole quarter of a moon he had to work, beg, cajole, and storm before he achieved the favor of an audience, which he the more ardently desired because he thought that, once exploited, there would be an end to his troubles. Such a service as he meant to render the master must ensure him the latter's abiding favor. The indomitable creature had plied two of the slaves of the bath with presents, to the end that with every jug of water which they poured over their puffing master's shoulders and chest, they should repeat, "Master, remember Dudu." They said it again when the dripping tower of flesh stepped out of the sunken basin onto the tiled floor to be dried with perfumed towels, one after the other, "Master, remember Dudu," until in exasperation he said, "Let him come and speak before me." They signed to the slaves who were waiting in the bedchamber to anoint and massage. These had likewise been bribed, and summoned the dwarf out of the western hall, where he was like to die with impatience, into the room with the bed standing in a niche. He raised his little palms aloft toward the kneading bench, where Pharaoh's friend stretched himself out and gave his flesh to the ministrations of the slaves. Dudu's dwarf head drooped meekly to one side between his lifted arms, as he awaited a syllable from Petipre's mouth or a glance from his eye. But neither came. The master only grunted softly as the slaves attacked his flesh, working his shoulders, hips, and thighs, the fat feminine arms and fleshy bosom with oil of nard, even turning the small, fine head the other way as it lay on the leather cushion, so that it did not look at Dudu. That was vexatious, but his affair was so hopeful that he would not desist or be cast down. "May your destiny endure 1,000 years, he said, "first of mankind, warrior of the highest. 4 jars for your entrails, and for your abiding image, a coffin of alabaster." "Thanks," Petipre answered him. He said it in Babylonian, as we might say, "merci," and added, "Will the man take long with what he has to say?" The man was bitter, but Dudu's hopes were too high. He would not be abashed. "Not long, my son and master," he gave answer. "Rather, briefly and to the point." And at a sign from Petipre's little hand, he put one foot before him, laid his stumpy arms on his back, and began, his nether lip drawn in, the other sticking out over it like a thatch. He knew that he could not say all that he had to say before the slaves, but felt sure that Petipre would soon dismiss them to listen in private. His beginning might be called skillful, except that it lacked in fine feeling. He began with praise of Min, god of the harvest, who in some localities was honored as a form of the sun power, but it had to name his name to Amun-Re and become, as Amun-Min, or Min-Amun-Re, one person with him, so that Pharaoh as readily spoke of my father Min as of my father Amun, especially at the harvest festival or the feast of the crowning, when the Min aspect of Amun was predominant and he became the fruitful god, protector of desert wanderers, towering in feathers and mighty in procreative power, the Ithyphallic sun. Him, then, Dudu evoked in all his dignity, appealing to him as he implored the countenance of his master, in that he, as upper servant of the house and scribe of the master's wardrobe, did not confine his zeal for his office to the narrower round of his duties, but, husband and father as he was, author of the being of two well-proportioned children, called so-and-so, to whom, unless all signs failed, and there was nothing in the coy confession which Jesset his wife whispered to him, a third would soon be added. As he was saying, then, he who had himself given increase to the house and was bound by a special reverence to the majesty of Min, and thus to Amun in his Min aspect, gave an eye to the welfare of the house in general, and in particular from the point of view of human fruitfulness and propagation. He had taken under his special protection and supervision everything that came to pass in the household in this field, all such happy events as marriages and consummations, bringing home the bride, fertility of the womb, childbed, and so on, encouraging all the household folk in such activities, spurring them on, and in his own person setting them an example of diligence and established order. For much depended upon a good example from those in authority. Not quite the highest authority, of course, for naturally, where nothing could be taken upon oneself, this could not either. So much the more important and necessary was it that precautions be taken to avoid disturbing the sacred tranquillity of that apex of their household structure which stood above the need of setting an example. But those just beneath him were, in his, Dudu's opinion, bound to lead an exemplary life, not only orderly, but also diligent in the activities before mentioned. He hoped that thus far the speaker had the approval of his lord and son. Petipre shrugged his shoulders and rolled over on his belly to give the rubbers a chance to work on his massive back. But he lifted his small, well-shaped head to ask what Dudu meant by his words about disturbing the master's tranquillity, and the remarks about dignity and the reverse. "Your upper servant will come to that at once," replied the dwarf, and spoke of the departed Montcaw, whose course of life had been so upright, and who had married early the child of a state official, and would have become a father had not fate dealt hardly by him and shattered his prospects, so that, well-meaning as he was, he had ended his days as a downcast widower. So much for Montcaw. But now he would speak of the brightness of the present. Bright, in so far that the deceased had found a successor of equal standing, or, if not quite equal, being a foreigner, yet not inferior to him in gifts, and they had welcomed to the headship over the house a youth of very considerable parts. His name, to be sure, had a somewhat decadent sound, but his face was ingratiating. He talked well and seemed astute. In short, an individual of very evident advantages. "Ass," muttered Petipre into his folded arms, "for nothing sounds sillier to us than praise of an object whose true worth we think ourselves better able to gauge than anyone else." Dudu pretended not to hear. The master may have called him an ass, but it was better to take no notice, in order to keep up his courage. He could not, he said, give enough praise to the fascinating, yes, really dazzling, and for some people distracting qualities of the youth in question. It was just these which gave weight to the anxiety he, Dudu, felt for the stability and well-being of the household, to the headship of which these qualities had raised the young man. "What is he jabbering about?" Petipre said, lifting his head a little and turning it in the direction of the rubber. "The steward's qualities threaten the stability of the household?" Jabbering was pretty bitter, too, but the dwarf was not to be put off. "They need not in the least, under other circumstances, be anything but a blessing to the house. That is, if they were legally circumscribed and ameliorated, or still better, had been so circumscribed beforehand. For such qualities, such an attractive face, such astuteness and eloquence, could otherwise become the source of much unrest, ferment, and derangement in their vicinity." And Dudu expressed regret that the youthful steward, whose religious affiliations were quite obscure, had refrained from paying due tribute to the majesty of Min, had remained unmarried in his high office, and not taken to himself a bedfellow suitable to his birth. For instance, the Babylonian slave Ishtarumi of the House of Women, and added his offspring to the children in the courtyard. That was regrettable. It was bad. It was serious. It was even dangerous. Not alone did the household suffer diminution to its state, but a bad example was set in the point of stability and fruitfulness. And even that was not the worst, for thirdly, there was, so to speak, no check upon the beguiling charms which undeniably the young steward possessed, and of which they stood in such need, and had for a long time needed, to guard against their inflammable, head-turning, sense-destroying effect upon the household. To prevent them, in short, from sowing the wind not only upon their own social level, but also in spheres far above it. There was a pause. Petitpré lent himself to be massaged, and did not answer. It was either or, Dudu declared. Such a young man must either submit to the marriage yoke, so that his gifts might not strew destruction like wildfire throughout the house, but be brought into the peaceful haven of wedlock, or else it would be better to wield the knife as a preventive measure and effect the sanative neutralization which would secure exalted persons from the disturbance of their rest and preserve their honor and dignity unscathed. Another silence. Petitpré suddenly turned on his back, so that the masseurs working upon him were interrupted, and stood with their hands in the air. He lifted his head toward the dwarf, measuring him from head to foot and back again, a short distance for Petitpré's eyes, and then glanced over to the armchair where lay his clothes, his sandals, his fan, and other insignia. Then he rolled round again, his head in his arms. He was filled with a cold, shuddering anger, a sort of outraged alarm at the threat to his peace of mind from this disgusting Hop o' My Thumb. Obviously the misbegotten fool knew something, and wanted to tell it to him. And if it was true, certainly he, Petitpré, had to know it, though he felt that to be told it was the grossest unkindness. Is all well in the house? Naught untoward has happened? Is the mistress happy? Yes, that was it. He was going to be given the wrong answer to the question. He hated the man, this man most of all, not being prepared to hate anybody else, and aside from any question of the truth of what the dwarf would say. He would have to send away the masseurs and be alone with this valiant little guardian of his honor, to let him rouse it up, whether with truth or with calumny. Honor. What was that in the present connection? It was sexual honor, the honor of the cock, which consists in the faithfulness of the hen, as a sign that he is a complete specimen of cockishness, from whom she will get such satisfaction that it will never occur to her to take up with anyone else, nor would she be tempted by the advances of any other cock, no matter how well equipped. But if this happens, and she has to do with another, everything is altered. There is sexual dishonor. The cock becomes a cuckold, which is as good as saying he becomes a capon. He is made ridiculous with horns which she sets on his head, and if anything is still to be saved, he must save it by running a sword through the rival whom she hoped to enjoy, and perhaps better yet, by killing her too, in order by that striking and sanguinary deed to re-establish his self-respect in his own eyes and those of the world. Honor. Petitpré had no honor whatever. He lacked it in his very flesh. He had no comprehension of what this cockish attribute might be, and it seemed frightful to him when others, for instance this pompous little scribe, wanted to make much of it. But he had a heart, one capable of doing justice. That is, he had the sense of the rights of others. It was a sensitive heart, dependent upon the love and loyalty of others. He hoped for their love, and, being betrayed, was so constituted as to suffer bitterly. During this pause, while the masseurs set to work again on his tremendous back, and he kept his face buried in his fat, feminine arms, all sorts of thoughts coursed through his mind. They had to do with two persons, on whose love and loyalty he so fervently built that one might say he loved them. Moot, his chief wife, whom he hated a little, too, because of the reproach which, of course, she could not utter, and yet did, by her very existence, utter, nonetheless, to whom he would dearly have liked to show himself strong and loving, and Joseph, who did him so much good, who knew how to make him feel better than wine, and for whose sake, to his own regret, he had had to refuse to show himself strong and loving to his wife in that twilight hour in the Western Hall. Petipre was not without an intuition of what he had then refused her. To tell the truth, even during that conjugal conversation, he had been vaguely aware that the reasons she gave for her request were only a pretext, the real ground being fear of herself on account of his honor. But since he lacked that kind of honor, her fear had seemed less important to him than the retaining of the youth who did him good. He had preferred him to her, and by abandoning his wife to her fear, he had challenged them both to prefer each other and betray him. He saw all that, and it wounded him, for he had a heart. Yet he saw it, for that heart was inclined to fairness, if perhaps only out of indolence, and because fairness can counteract anger and thirst for revenge. Probably he felt, too, that it is also the safest refuge of dignity. Evidently this hateful guardian of his honor was trying to tell him that his dignity was being betrayed by treachery, as though, he thought, dignity ceased to be dignity when it had to hide its head and suffer from treachery, as though the betrayed were not more dignified than the betrayer. But if he is not, because he has himself incurred guilt and invited treachery, yet justice, fair-mindedness, is always there, so that dignity may find in its own guilt and the rights of others, and there establish itself anew. So then Petipre the eunuch strove after justice, at once and before everything else, whatever might be brought up against him from the side of honor. Justice is a spiritual quality, by contrast with the fleshliness of honor, and as he lacked the latter, he was perforce, he knew, thrown back upon justice. It was on the spiritual he had relied, with both of these who now, as this informer and intriguant seemed to want to tell him, had broken their faith. So far as he knew, both were secured by powerful spiritual considerations against the flesh, for both of them were set apart and in the spirit belonged together. The woman, with all her compensations, Amun's wife and bride of his temple, who danced before him in the narrow garment of the goddess, and the devoted youth with the wreath of consecration in his hair, the boy, touch me not. Had the flesh mastered them? He grew cold with terror at the thought, for the flesh was his enemy, despite his superfluity of it, and always when he came home and asked, "Is all well? Naught untoward has happened?" His subconscious anxiety had been lest the flesh have somehow gained the mastery over the forbearing, careful, yet not trustworthy bond of the spirit, and brought about some frightful disruption. But his cold shivers did not exclude some anger, too. For did he have to know? Could they not have left him in peace, anyhow? If those two dedicated persons had been overpowered by the flesh behind his back, and had secrets from him, yet in that very secrecy and betrayal lay a forbearing love, for which he was very ready to be grateful. But for that creature there, the pompous little guardian of honor who was trying to give him unasked-for enlightenment and make a vulgar attack upon his peace of mind, for him he felt nothing but inexpressible dislike. "Are you nearly done?" he asked. He was thinking of the masseurs, whom he would have to send away, and did not want to be compelled by that spy and sneak to do so against his will. But there was nothing for it. They were perfect blockheads. You might say that they had made themselves clods, because it suited their calling to be so. But though certainly they had not understood a word up to now, nor were any more likely to understand the rest, yet Petipre could scarcely ignore the silent intimation of his tormentor that he would speak with him alone. It made him dislike him still more vehemently. "Go not before you have finished," he said, "and there is no special need of haste. But if you are done, give me my sheet, and then go when you like." They would never have understood that they were to go, whether finished or no. But since they really were, they smoothed the linen sheet up to their master's chin over his ponderous bulk, flung themselves on their faces, touching their narrow foreheads to the ground, and went off with arms akimbo in a sort of waddling trot, which was evidence enough of their self-satisfied stupidity were more needed. "Come closer, my friend," said the Chamberlain. "Come as close as you will, and find proper for what you have to tell me, for it seems to be something better not shouted to the housetops, but rather something that brings us to close grips, which I take to be an advantage, whatever else may be said of it. You are a valuable servant, small indeed, far below the average, and in this respect a figure of fun, but you have poise and dignity, and qualities which justify you in assuming responsibility beyond the duties of your office, having an eye over the house, and especially over its fertility. Not that I remember installing you in this charge, for I do not. But I do so now, for I cannot avoid recognizing your calling to it. If I understand aright, your love and duty urge you to impart to me certain disturbing information in your special field of oversight and accounting, of events which might kindle disorder in the house?"